Okay, so I will pick up pretty much where Matthias left off and talk about QCD effects in exclusive Higgs production. I had a few, kind of introductory things to say that since there was some discussion of the inclusive cross sections, I'll flash them up there, and that's also going to be useful to draw a contrast between the perturbative series behavior for the inclusive case and for the case when you actually start imposing cuts. Okay, so just as a bit of motivation, and I'll refer to Xianbing's talk from yesterday also, it's starting to become clear that theory errors are playing and are going to play a continued important role in interpreting the properties of the state that we found in the LHC. So here's some discussion from a couple of years ago showing the importance of theory uncertainties from HCP 2011. Here's some comments from CMS and Atlas. So in the WW channel, CMS, overall signal efficiency uncertainty is dominated by the theoretical uncertainty. In the gamma gamma channel, this is also an important component of the error budget. From Xianbing yesterday, what we saw was the following table, just showing the systematic uncertainties in the WW channel at Atlas. And what you can see is that theory uncertainties really are dominating this right now. So it's something that we're going to have to control better as we proceed forward into the analysis and interpretation phase. Okay, so this is going to be maybe a little bit of overlap with Matthias, but it's just going to be for a couple slides. Just to kind of set the stage, I want to talk just a second about the inclusive cross-section. So Matthias did a great job of explaining the fact that these receive very large corrections in perturbation theory, and we've now identified the sources of this. So for example, let's just do a quick calculation here. Let's calculate an NLO and the effective field theory. And there's basically several sources of large corrections. We can debate about which one is the largest one, but there's the analytic continuation that Matthias showed you, that pi squared factor, which comes with a large coefficient CA. There's also large logarithms coming from the Eichenholz emission of the soft gluons. And something very important for dictating LHC phenomenology is that these large factors are identical when you actually work in the effective theory that Matthias told you about, where you integrate out the top quark, and in the full theory. If you actually were to compute this with the full top quark mass dependence, you'd find that these large circle terms here are the same. So this is how you actually approximate the LHC cross-section. This is the framework that you use, this effective top quark mass approximation, because of this fact that you have these identical large factors in both the full and the effective theories. So this is the approximation that's actually used. And as Matthias said, this works to the percent level over a wide range of Higgs masses, in particular for Higgs masses of 125, which we're now interested in. Here's just a comparison between exact and this approximate formula here in this little green line. You can see that it's good to the percent level or better. Okay, and just to kind of continue here, and actually it seems like my font was chosen to be white for some of this. That wasn't on purpose, but sorry, Matthias. So this is just to kind of highlight that since Matthias did such a great job of explaining it, so the reference is there, but in any case. So people have now studied this. It's a problem with my fonts. People have now studied this in enormous detail. People have put in QCD effects, pi squared resummation effects from matching electroweak corrections. People have really studied this to death right now. And just to show you the current numbers being used, and unfortunately, this can't be directly compared to the numbers Matthias showed you because I actually put the 8 TeV numbers in there. Sorry about that. But these are roughly the numbers that are being used. So PDF and alpha S uncertainties of roughly plus or minus 7 to 8%. Scale uncertainties of roughly plus or minus 7 to 8% is what's being used right now. And for more details on this, Matthias, of course, talked about that. What I want to do now is I want to talk about what happens when you start imposing cuts. And I want to start off with an example. So let's talk about another important Higgs channel, that of associated production, so V Higgs production. This is interesting, as we know, for measurements of the bottom Yukawa coupler. And let's go ahead and compute this inclusively. So just inclusive QCD perturbation theory integrating over the entire final state phase space. And what you find is you find a fairly reasonably well-behaved perturbative expansion. So you calculate it next to leading order QCD, you find a correction of roughly plus 30%, smaller than what Matthias told you, just because, again, as he said, you take CA to CF, the correction goes down. You compute it next to leading order QCD, plus or minus 1 or 2%. Electroweak effects are also known. This is a very well-behaved perturbative expansion. You start off, you have a correction of 30%, you have a correction of 1 or 2%. However, experimentally, we actually impose cuts on this. And let's actually take a slide from Xianbing yesterday just to show you what's done in this analysis. So in order to take advantage of different S over B ratios, because the background changes as you look in different regions of phase space, let's go ahead and split this up into different categories of PT, let's say, of the W or Z boson, depending upon which vector boson you're looking at. So here's just taken from Jianming, and you can see that there are categories where you actually start imposing large cuts, okay, on the PTs of the jets or on the PTs of the Higgs equivalently. What you also do along with this, at least in the canonical analyses that are talked about in the literature, is you also impose a jet veto. Okay, and jet vetoes is going to be the subject of this talk. So what I want to do is I want to look to see what happens to this nice perturbative expansion where we actually impose both this large cut here on the, let's say, PT, and also impose a jet veto. And this is kind of interesting to see what happens. The perturbative expansion completely changes. You went from having corrections of, let's say, plus or minus plus 30% or so, to the following situation that's illustrated in this following plot from these authors, where you go from leading order in black, the next leading order in red, then NNLO in blue. And if you actually look at the numbers that are shown in this plot, that 30% increase turns into actually a decrease of a factor of 2. Okay, so this is an enormous change in your perturbative expansion. And this is actually what's done experimentally. Okay, so this is what we want to try to understand in this talk. What's actually leading to these huge changes, and can we control it somehow? And just another example, this is again taken from a talk yesterday. And now, you know, when I think many of us read through the experimental papers, we actually start to get worried when we see comments like jet vetoes. When we see experimentalists saying we're putting a jet veto or we're vetoing events in certain categories, we start getting worried about what the perturbative series is going to look like. So here's just another example. I don't have any numbers for this, but I might be interested to look into from Mike's talk. In the Tao Tao channel, there's similar types of cuts imposed. And along with these similar cuts, you can also see there's a large scale. And it really is going to be this hierarchy between the scales associated with the high energy scale, in this case MJJ greater than 500 is a very large scale, and the low scale, which in this case is a jet veto of roughly 25 to 30 GeV. Okay, so it's the jet vetoes that are leading to these large corrections. And why are jet vetoes dangerous? It's pretty easy to see this with a simple example. Let's just take E plus E minus to jets, and let's compute it at next leading order in QCD. What we'll do, of course, as we know we have to do, is we have to sum corrections that are virtual in origin coming from additional loops and corrections that actually have additional gluons emitted into the final state, so really mission corrections. We know that in order to get a finite result, we have to include both of these pieces. So we compute them, and we find in dimensional regularization, these have some divergence in dimensional regularization that goes like 1 over epsilon squared. These really mission corrections, when we integrate over the phase space of the gluons, have an additional 1 over epsilon squared with the opposite sign. These two divergences cancel. However, we're left over with a large logarithm associated with what cut do we put on these gluons in the final state? What PT cut do we put on them? We know that this has to be here. We know a logarithm of this form has to exist because we know as we basically take the PT cut to zero, we effectively remove these diagrams and the divergence shows up again. So we know that as in the limit that the PT cut on this additional final state jet goes to zero, we have to basically reproduce the divergences of the virtual corrections. So you can think of this as kind of an incomplete cancellation of IR divergences in the presence of this final state phase space cut. This leads to large logarithms between the high scale and the problem, in this case, basically the center of mass energy associated with these two final state jets, and the low scale, which is the PT cut. Okay? And the important thing to note for Higgs production is that just like these pi squared factors that Matthias was talking about, this comes with a large coefficient. It comes with a color factor of CA, and it turns out you get an additional factor of 2 here just coming from the fact you can emit a gluon off either leg. And you get a term which is of the form 6 alpha S over pi times log squared of MH over PT veto. And if you just evaluate this for the numbers relevant for experimental searches, it gives you a correction to a leading order prediction of roughly a factor of 1/2. This is a very large correction. Okay, and clearly your perturbative expansion is not just an alpha S anymore. It's an alpha S times CA times a logarithm squared. So this is something you have to deal with. You have to reorganize your perturbative series. Okay, so why are jet vetoes used? Well, experimentally, they're basically required, and you've all seen this plot many times, but let me show it again. This is an older plot now from Atlas showing you the background composition as a function of jet multiplicity relevant for the WW search. So you can see in the zero jet bin, if we look at the backgrounds, it's roughly divided between blue, which is WW, and green, which is Z plus jets. However, when we go to the one and two jet bins, you see a very large TT bar background start to appear, as shown here by the yellow histograms. So in order to take advantage of the fact that there's different backgrounds in these different jet multiplicities, and therefore you can optimize separately if you put different cuts in these jet multiplicity bins, that's how the analysis is usually organized. And the number that typically is used by Atlas and CMS is something between 25 and 30 GeV. Okay, so you have this situation where you have a high scale, the Higgs mass, and a low scale, the PT cut. So let's go ahead and let's go back and do what was done originally when one was trying to estimate the uncertainties for the cross sections in the presence of these jet vetoes, and let's just take a fixed order calculation, in this case at next to next to leading order, and let's take the scales that we have, the renormalization and factorization scales, and let's vary them up and down in the normal fashion. Take the Higgs mass as the center value and vary up and down by a factor of 2. And you could take PT Vito as a central value too. You would get a very different plot, yes, I agree. But I don't think in this case that would be the relevant scale to choose. What you need to do, of course, is you need to have two separate scales in here, as we know. Let's just take this. This is the canonical simplest thing one could imagine doing. And let's vary by a factor of 2. And let's look at this red band, okay? So this red band shows you the uncertainty that you would estimate as a function of the jet veto, shown here in the lower axis, at NNLO. And what you find for relevant values around 25 or 30 GeV is you find an uncertainty of about 5 or 6%. And this already is a little bit funny, because your inclusive scale variation is roughly, let's call it 10%. So what you've done is you've taken the perturbed expansion, you've changed it from an expansion alpha s to an expansion in a larger parameter, alpha s times a logarithm squared, and you find that your uncertainty went down. Okay, so this is counterintuitive. It's not really what you expect. Okay, you've taken your cross section, you've made a more complicated perturbative expansion, you found the error has gone down. So what is happening? Okay, and I should also point out that this is not just limited to the Higgs plus 0 jet bin. There's a similar effect in, for example, the Higgs plus 1 jet bin. So here's a plot where you can see the fixed order result, the naive way of doing the scale variation that I just showed you, implemented in these green lines right here. And you can see that it's quite small, and you can also see there's a point where the scale variation basically crosses over. The value used for your upper band and the value used for the lower band meet, okay, leading to an uncertainty estimate of around 0, which you clearly know is incorrect. Okay, so there was a nice study of the cross-section structure about a year or so ago now that started to identify the reason for why this happens. So you can take the cross-section, and let's use the zero jet bin as an example, okay? And what you can do is you can write that as a difference of two cross-sections that we're going to think of as having independent perturbative expansions. We're going to write the zero jet cross-section as a total cross-section minus the cross-section for greater than or equal to one jet. And the reason we can start to think about these as independent expansions is because sigma total depends only upon the parameter alpha s, whereas the greater than or equal to 1 jet cross-section depends upon this alpha s times logarithm squared that I told you about. So in the limit that this logarithm is large, these are independent perturbative expansions. We can think of them that way. So let's go ahead and form this difference. So you have one series right here minus another series right here. And it turns out that both of these series have very large corrections. The total cross-section has large corrections coming from the reasons that Matthias told you about in the previous talk. So you have your, here's your cross-section normalized to some leading order prediction. And you can see that the coefficients in the alpha s expansion at fixed order are quite large. 9.5 times alpha s, 35 times alpha s squared. In the greater than or equal to 1 jet cross-section, there are also large terms at each order in perturbation theory, coming from these logarithms. This L here is basically logarithm of MH over PT cut. This is a large quantity. And you can see that this perturbative series also has large coefficients. In fact, since you're taking the difference, these two coefficients, let's say 9.5 and 4.7, they cancel to some extent. At NNLO, 35 and 26 cancel to a large extent. So you have a cancellation between these two perturbative series that you're putting into the zero jet bin. And there's really, one should think of this, at least the argument made by these folks, is one should think of this as accidental. These have different origins, these large corrections. These ones come from pi squared factors. These ones come from large logarithms. There's really no reason for them to cancel. And there's no reason for this cancellation that occurs right here to persist necessarily at higher orders. There's another study that looked into this, which I think is a kind of convincing one. So what you can do is you can say, OK, let me take what I know, which is the cross-section for Higgs production through order alpha s squared, the next to next leading order cross-section, and let's go ahead and try to extend this in different ways to the next higher order. Let's try to extend this to order alpha s cubed in a few different ways. There's a study by these folks, and what they actually studied was the fraction of events in the zero jet bin. So it's a slightly different quantity, but for our purposes, it's sufficient to look at this one. So let's look at three ways of taking the fraction of events in the zero-jet bin and extending it from alpha s squared to order alpha s cubed using information that we have. Okay. These three things I'm going to describe to you are all going to be the same through order alpha s squared, but they'll differ at the order beyond what we currently know. So this prescription A basically says take everything you know about the perturbative expansion in the numerator. So the numerator here is the cross-section with the jet veto. Put everything you know about that in the numerator, and in the denominator, put everything you know about the expansion, the total cross-section. Put the leading order, the NLO, and the NNLO. So if you were to expand out this denominator in alpha s, you would be including some terms of order alpha s cubed, order alpha s fourth, and beyond. So that's one thing you can do to define this jet veto efficiency. Another thing you can do, and let me jump down to prescription C right here, another thing you can do is say, I don't know anything beyond order alpha s squared, so let me take this formula and let me expand it strictly through order alpha s squared. Let me do a strict expansion and keep only through order alpha s squared. There's an intermediate thing that you can do, which is motivated by the fact that this efficiency kind of has a perturbative expansion that only really begins at order alpha s, because at order alpha s to the zero, it's just one. There's really no effect from the cut. And so this motivates you to take one minus basically next leading order ratio between the cross-section with a cut and the cross-section without a cut. So three different prescriptions. They only differ at order alpha s cubed. But what you can see is that numerically, they have a very large spread. So here it is. Here are the three prescriptions together with some scale uncertainty. In green, that's prescription C. In blue, that's A. And B is in red. And what you can see is for relevant values, which is basically this red line here, those are either Atlas or CMS values for what the cut is, you can see there's quite a large spread. Numerically, you have differences ranging from about 0.5 for this efficiency to 0.85. Okay, so this is telling you that the uncertainty that you're finding from just doing the scale variation isn't capturing this large difference between the various prescriptions. And you should have some other way of estimating what the error is. Okay, so here's one prescription for this. And let me try to explain the logic and then give you the numbers. So as we said before, in the limit that this logarithm is large, we should think about sigma total and sigma greater than or equal to 1 as having independent expansions. One is in alpha s, one is in alpha s times log squared. So when you write down the error matrix using this parameter, sigma total and sigma greater than or equal to 1, the errors are independent. So you can take the scale, you can vary them up and down, and you say they're independent because these are separate perturbative expansions in different quantities. So you can stick on the greater than or equal to 2 jet bin here, and your error matrix is diagonal. So these are things you compute using standard scale variations. Then in order to get to the experimentally measured 0 jet, 1 jet, and let's say greater than or equal to 2 jet here, what you would do is you would just transform this matrix. You would do a rotation, and you get an error matrix that now has off-diagonal terms. But perhaps more importantly, if I look in the 0 jet bin cross-section, you see that by construction, the error is now greater than or equal to, in fact, greater than the total cross-section error. So you have a construction now that's giving you an increased error, and it's obeying this logic that you kind of have in the back of your mind, that the error on the zero jet bin should be greater than the error on the total cross-section. Okay, so that's what you get from the 1-1 component of this error matrix here. And what you can do is you can plug in some numbers. And you can see that, okay, the total cross-section uncertainty is roughly 10%. You know, we can debate whether it's 7%, 8%, 10%, but let's just take 10%. And we can look at the error that you would compute, for example, for the greater than or equal to 1 jet cross-section. It's 21%. And in the 0 jet bin, we now have a result where the uncertainty is, let's say, roughly 17%. The 1 jet bin is 29%. So you've basically taken your fixed order calculations, and you've come up with a more sensible way to estimate the uncertainties. Okay, they obey the kind of the logic and the behavior that you expect them to have. However, one problem is that the uncertainties get larger. And of course, we want the uncertainties to be as small as possible. So what you want to do is you want to improve the situation somehow. And of course, one thing you can do is you can try to resum these large logarithms that are spoiling the perturbative expansions of the greater than or equal to 1 jet or even 0 jet cross sections. Okay. So there's been a lot of work on this recently in the community, and that's what I'm going to start talking about now. Let me first try to give you just a little bit of summary of what kind of stuff have been done. So people have studied the Higgs plus zero jet cross section through the next to next to leading logarithmic level. And just as kind of a crib sheet down here, I've written down what these LL, NLL, and NNLL refer to. So they just refer to resumming certain basically towers of terms of the perturbative expansion. So the leading log term would just have all alpha s to the n, l to the 2n terms. Next to leading log would include the next log down. So for example, alpha s times log or alpha s squared times log cubed. And the next to leading log would include the next couple of terms in these towers of logarithms. Okay, so that's what the nomenclature refers to. So Higgs plus zero-jet is now known through NNLL, and there's been basically work that's done kind of within a traditional QCD approach, you can say, and also work within an effective theory approach by Matthias and collaborators. There's been some study of so-called clustering log effects on the Higgs plus zero-jet cross-section, and I'll talk about that in a little bit. And finally, the Higgs plus one-jet cross-section has also been studied using this kind of resummation of these large logs to the next to leading logarithmic level. So this is what's currently known in the literature. So there's different prescriptions on how you actually count these logarithms in the literature. I can tell you that what I am doing right here is I'm expanding the actual cross-section, okay? And, you know, you could talk about whether this is NLL or NLL prime in the standard notation, but you should, just as maybe a summary of the discussion, is you should be a little bit careful when people use NLL and NNLL, because there's basically two different prescriptions in the literature. So hopefully people in their papers tell you what exactly they're doing. But I'll be doing the cross-section, at least for the third item on this list, it's a cross-section. Okay, so. Non-global logs would, for us, first appear at NLL prime. Okay, so there's a couple different approaches. There's an effective field theory approach and a traditional QCD approach to doing this resummation. I want to give you a feel for why you can do this resummation, why it works. And I think the clearest way to do this is within the effective field theory approach. So I'll follow what Matthias was talking about in the previous talk. And what I'll do is I'll talk about the Higgs plus one jet case as a specific example, but basically it's the same for the other cases. So what we'll do is we'll introduce modes that have particular scalings that capture the physics in the problem. We'll have a soft mode that has scaling of, let's say, mh times a small parameter. The small parameter is just the value of pt veto over mh. I could swap out mh with the square root of s hat, and that would be more relevant for Higgs plus one jet. For the other cases, the hard scale you would think of as mh, but it's basically the same thing. So we have soft modes, basically, that can be emitted at any region of phase space. We have collinear modes along the beam directions. Okay, they have a scaling in light cone parameters of lambda squared and 1 for the 2 plus and minus directions, and the transverse momentum is of order lambda, so it's suppressed. And for the Higgs plus 1 jet case, you'd have additional collinear modes that go along the jet direction in the final state. So these are the modes relevant for the effective theory. And the interesting thing about this is when you actually write down the distance measure for the anti-KT algorithm, it clusters these modes in a very special way. Okay, so here's the distance measure is relevant for the anti-KT algorithm. So it's, you've probably all seen this. So I take the distance measure between two partons, let's say, in the final state. It's the minimum of 1 over pt for each of those times delta r over r. R is some parameter typically taken to be roughly 0.4 or 0.5. And as you know, what you do is you basically compute all these distances. You take the two smallest distances, you combine them together, you have a new mode, and then you keep reiterating this algorithm until you've identified the number of jets that you have in the final state. And let's take a look at how these various modes are clustered by the anti-KT algorithm. So what you do is you write down the distance measures, let's say computing two modes within the jet collinear sector between, let's say, the jet sector and the A sector, which would be one of the beam sectors, between two soft modes written here as rho SS, et cetera. So you just go compute the distance measures between all these modes. And what you see is that the smallest one actually is between the two jet, let's say, emissions. So I take collinear modes along the jet direction. You see that those have the smallest separation because these parameters, 1 over r and 1 over lambda, that enter here are large parameters. R is small and lambda is small, so the inverse of them is large. So the first thing that happens is that you combine radiation along the jet direction into a single state. Okay? In particular, what then happens is that you first combine all the jet radiation together before you actually cluster the soft radiation together with this jet radiation. So what this tells you is that the soft radiation doesn't actually probe inside a jet. It just feels the entire jet as a single object along a single direction. Okay, so, Matthias. Sorry? Where? This 1 over r is between. Oh, if you look at, basically it's the size of the jet cone. You get the size of the jet cone up top. You get an R up top that cancels the 1 over R and gives you something of order 1. Basically, the separation between two things within the jet cone, within the jet, is set by the radius of the jet cone. So you'll get an R over an R, and you'll just get 1. Which jet size? R? Well, R is, of course, the anti-KT parameter. What I have to do is the experimentalists tell me what they measure. And what we're basically showing here is that the value of R and the anti-KT algorithm itself leads you to write, it allows you to write down a nice effective theory approach to this problem. That's basically the message. The way the anti-KT algorithm clusters these different modes allows you to basically separate all these sectors. And that's kind of what I'm in the middle of showing. Is it clear that I would only have these modes here?
Right.
I think it's clear. I mean, these are kind of the relevant directions and the relevant energies in the problem. If you try to look at, for example, this, let's say as just an example, this lambda squared, lambda squared, lambda squared mode that Matthias was showing you for sket 1 in the beginning of his talk, you'd find that this is basically, in dim reg, it would be scaleless. It just wouldn't contribute to this observable. Okay. So when you do the kind of analysis for all possible scalings, you're going to get this, okay? There's no lambda squared scaling here, for example. These things are fairly well checked. I mean, there's all sorts of, you know, there's all sorts of issues that probably are still hanging around associated with the Glauber modes and various other weird scalings here, but it's not going to affect this kind of study. Okay, so the first thing that happens is you cluster all the jet radiation together, which tells you that the soft radiation is only sensitive to basically a collinear direction. It's not sensitive to the details of what's going on inside that jet. That's the first nice thing that happens. The second nice thing that happens is if you actually look at the distance measures for example, clustering soft radiation together or clustering collinear radiation along the beam pipe together, that clustering occurs first before you start to cluster soft radiation with the collinear radiation down the beam pipe. So what this tells you is that you can actually split the soft and collinear radiation. Okay, so you can write down separate description of soft radiation, separate description of collinear radiation, and these things lead you to basically write down the kind of formula that Matthias showed you in the first talk. So you can write down the cross section, let's say in the zero jet case, as a hard function, times separate functions, the so-called beam functions that describe collinear radiation down the beam pipe, times a soft function that basically connects soft radiation to all of these separate directions. You can write down a similar formula for Higgs plus 1 or even N jets, where the only difference is you now have separate jet functions that describe the radiation in the final state. Okay? So the whole point of this anti-KT algorithm scaling argument we went through is to show you that basically it allows you to factor these emissions into separate sectors and deal with them independently. Okay? Okay, so let me now show you some numerical results. I'll try to step through the various groups that have done this to show you what they're coming up with. So here's some results from Thomas and Matthias, showing you the zero jet cross section on the left plot and the actual efficiency on the right plot. This is showing you different orders in the perturbative expansion. So the resummation is done to next to leading logarithmic level. Then it's a match to a fixed order calculation at either NLO or NLO. And you can see, This plot didn't come out as well as I wanted to here, but you can kind of see the basic idea is that the scale variation is larger with the NLO result, and it's decreased when you actually match to the NNLO. I could have shown you an equivalent plot where there was only an NLL resummation, and then compared that to an NNLL resummation, you would have shown a similar effect. The basic message is that you really start to control these uncertainties when you actually include both the resummation and the higher fixed order results, and that's a point I'll come back to at the end. Okay, something else that maybe people should talk about at some point who do this kind of stuff is the fact that everyone estimates their uncertainties very differently. And you can get quite different results in the literature depending upon how you do that. But in any case, this calculation, you have several scales in the problem associated with these different sectors. You vary scales independently, you add them in quadrature.
Well, I thought the procedure is to vary by
too. Well, but now you have many different scales in the problem. Okay, and so do you vary them separately and add in quadrature? Do you vary them all together and take an envelope? How do you deal with this uncertainty coming from these different prescriptions that I showed you in the other analysis? So it makes some difference. You mean less at this order? Yeah. The hope is that when you start to include an NLL that all the differences between these various prescriptions start to kind of lessen, and you start to converge once you've put enough information in. Okay, here's another result from, I guess, the traditional QCD approach, you could call it. So here is just a slide I stole showing you how these folks do their estimate of the uncertainty. So they have, for the usual renormalization and factorization scales. They vary them by a factor of 2 around a central scale choice. They have a resummation scale that they again vary by a factor of 2. They also take basically two different schemes that I showed you before, two different schemes of extending beyond the currently known order. And they basically compute all this stuff and they take the envelope. Okay? So they take an envelope and that gives them some uncertainty, which if you look at this line right here is roughly plus or minus 10%. Okay. Here's just this showing this again a little more accurately to get their numbers. So they have estimated uncertainty of 11.5% on the zero jet bin. And you can compare this to what you get at fixed order. And they have some their way of doing it at fixed order, which is basically roughly 16%. This turns out to be consistent with the Stewart-Tachman prescription that I told you about. So what you can see is what you're gaining, okay, from going from fixed order to including the resum calculation. So you're decreasing the uncertainty within this calculation by roughly 5%. So you're gaining something, okay, by adding in the resummation. Let me show you some results from the Higgs plus one jet case. So you see very similar behavior. So this is for particular choices of PT. I'll talk a little bit about this in the beginning, in a second. So you can see a fixed order. It didn't come out as well as I wanted on this plot here, but you can see fixed order would be the difference between these red bands. And you can see two things. One, you can see an artificial shrinking of the scale variation for certain values of PT veto, giving you an indication that your fixed order calculation is breaking down. You can see that experimentally relevant values of the jet veto of roughly 25 or 30 GeV, you're getting a fairly large scale variation. You put in the resummation, which is the blue band, and you can see that you've basically improved the prediction. Okay, you have a much less scale variation in the relevant region. You fixed this problem of having this crossover in the scale variation bands.
So how sensitive is this variation to R?
Let me say a word about R in a little bit. I'm going to get into R. Okay, one more caveat about this particular analysis. So when you actually start looking at Higgs plus one jet, you have a lot more parameters to play around with. And in particular, you have to be careful about describing the entire Higgs plus one jet spectrum correctly. And you can identify basically two relevant regions. You can identify a region where the PT of the actual jet observed in the final state is much, much greater than PT veto. Depending upon how you define this exactly, you get something like 30 to 50% of the spectrum. You can also identify a region where PT jet is roughly equal to PT veto. And actually, for those values, you need a new effective field theory. And what you would basically do is you would say, I have only soft emissions in the final state, soft plus beam collinear emissions. I wouldn't have this additional hard collinear direction. So you need a new FT, new EFT for that. It's something that can be developed and, you know, will be developed, but it's you know, not done yet.
But I don't see how we get a large plot.
For in this case,
yeah.
You still have MH. Okay, let's say a word or two about R, okay, since it's kind of an important issue to talk about. So it turns out that if you actually look at the parameters that appear in the problem, you have more than just PT veto over MH. That's one parameter that appears in the problem, but another parameter that appears is R. Okay, so in principle, you can have logs of R or other effects in the jet radius. And it turns out there's kind of really only a narrow window where you can do the resummation that I just talked about. Okay, it turns out to be exactly the experimentally interesting region, but if you try to play around with the parameters by taking R smaller or R larger, you're going to run into trouble. And in particular, there's two forms of trouble you can run into. You can imagine taking R much, much greater than the ratio PT veto over MH, in which case you come up with a problem of soft collinear mixing. And what this means is that, well, I'll talk a little bit more about what this means, but basically you have large terms that appear at every order in perturbation theory that go like R squared. And if R is a fairly large quantity, it's going to basically dominate over the logarithms that you've resummed. Similarly, if you take R smaller, you can have log of R effects known as clustering logarithms that again can be larger than the results that you've basically put in your cross-section, the logs of PT over MH. Okay, so what is soft collinear mixing? It's pretty easy to understand. So we've separated soft modes and collinear modes in our effective theory. We've said that basically the way the clustering works is that they're clustered separately. We can split their effects into separate functions. But if I start taking my jet radius larger and larger, I can have basically both soft and collinear radiation going into the same jet cone, in which case there's some mixing between these sectors. Okay? You know, it's shown pictorially right here. If you draw R large enough, you're going to put both of these things into the same sector. And what you get is you just compute the cross section and you find that you have a correction to the zero jet cross section that goes like a logarithm of image of a PT cut times R squared. And if R is large, this is a large correction. And it's something that you don't have control over. Okay. I'll let you comment on a second. There has been some discussion by Matthias and collaborators about how if you correctly remove the double counting in the effective theory, so double counting, I believe, between the different collinear modes, that this effect should vanish. Now, I think this is a subject that's still under some debate, but I'm going to forget about it completely because if you just phenomenologically look at the parameters, you find that R is not really that large. So this is just not phenomenologically the relevant limit. So we can just forget about the soft collinear mixing effect. It would be an interesting question if R was larger, if you started putting in a large jet cone. So if you're looking now at some boosted analysis where you're taking R large, maybe you would have to come back and revisit this kind of issue. But for the time being, 10-second comment. Then you're, yeah. I'd be interested in talking with some of the other folks who do this, whether they would agree with that statement, but, okay. Hopefully it will be published soon. Okay. But in any case, for current analyses, this isn't the right limit. So let's go on and let's talk about clustering logarithms. This is again something very simple to understand. You basically have two emissions that fall within the same jet cone, and you know you're going to have a divergence coming from these two emissions being collinear, and this divergence is cut off by the fact that you integrate over basically a radius r around your hard direction. And again, just like we talked about in the e plus e minus jets example, there is a residual of this collinear divergence that will just be 1 over epsilon minus 1 over epsilon r to some minus 2 epsilon, and if you just work this out, you get a log of r. So there's basically a leftover collinear divergence, if you wish. Okay. So that's another effect, and again, log of r is something that you don't have control over to all orders in perturbation theory. You don't know how to resum it. Okay. So if it's there, and if it's the dominant logarithm, what you resummed is not the right thing to resum. You should be worried about log of r instead. Happily, it turns out that for the experimentally interesting values of all the parameters, PT, MH, and R, this is not the dominant logarithm. The dominant logarithm really is this logarithm of PT over Q. And what I've attempted to do is kind of mock up a plot made by, I should put the references down here, made by these folks to show you the effect of each of these logarithms separately. So this is a little bit complicated plot, but there's basically three lines to look at. There's this upper line right here, which is just the NNLO inclusive cross-section and some normalization. There's this line, purple line, that I'm tracing out right here, and the difference between these two lines is basically the size of this large log that we have resummed. Okay? This orange line right here, the distance from zero to this orange line, is the size of log r that we have not resummed. Okay? And what you can just see is because of the actual numerical values of the parameters you're using, the logarithm that you have control over is dominant over the one that you do not have control over. So dealing with these log of r effects through the standard fixed order calculation should be sufficient for phenomenological purposes. But I think it's interesting to note that you're really right in the sweet spot experimentally with the values of MH, PT, Vito, and R. If you were to really change things around in any significant way, you would have to very much rethink the resummation that you've done. Okay, so let me give a little bit of a status here. So the formalism is now well established for Higgs plus zero and one jet. Something that I don't entirely understand is that the fact that there are some differences in how uncertainties are estimated by the various groups. I think that's something that maybe should be discussed in the future. I told you a little bit about how there's a little bit more development of the EFT formalism to get the entire one jet spectrum. One important thing to point out to the experimentalists in the audience is that right now, you know, there's a prescription that you're using, and you're basically plugging fixed order results into this prescription. We can do better than fixed order now. We have some results matched to fixed order. The uncertainties are smaller. So this is something that I think you should stay tuned for, and I think at some point soon, the numbers should start to be updated. Let me make one more comment about you know, what people are doing next. This is kind of an interesting problem for the following reason. You can identify several different limits in which you know, you can do a calculation. One limit might be if you have only one scale in the problem. such as the inclusive Higgs production cross-section or the Drellian cross-section, in which case, basically, you want to do a fixed order calculation. So this is just some random plot that I stole. It turns out this is beam thrust for the Higgs cross-section. And I just want to show it because it kind of highlights these different regions you could imagine studying a cross-section. And so, you know, there's a fixed order regime in which you don't have a large hierarchy between different scales. And you know how to do a calculation there. There's another regime where you actually are completely dominated by logarithms. So in this case, if you were to take PT cut very, very, very small, so imagine taking MH equals 125, take PT cut down to a GeV, you would be completely dominated by these large logarithms. And this would be the way you would have to tackle the problem. You would just work on the resummation. This is kind of an interesting problem because your logarithms in the case of Higgs plus jets, they're large, but they're not overwhelmingly large. So you actually have to deal with everything. You have to deal with all kinds of effects. You have to resum, you have to deal with fixed order, higher orders. You're really in this so-called transition region. So what could you imagine doing next, and what are people working on? Well, basically, you have to kind of work on both fronts. You have to work on the resummation, you have to work on the fixed order. So as far as next steps, there are groups working on trying to understand these clustering terms, which are, you know, of moderate numerical importance. Maybe they don't need to be resummed, and they aren't as dominant as the terms that are being resummed, but they are numerically a little larger than you would expect, and people are working on trying to extend a calculation of those to the next order.
Is this known that the leading term and leading order is log square r?
They claim it is. So these folks claim it is. They claim you're going to get a log r at every order.
One log at every order?
I believe that's a claim made. I'm taking this from them, and that's the statement that they've made. So that's one thing that's being worked on. Another thing you could imagine is just really, and this I think is really going to be necessary at the end of the day, is to do an honest calculation of Higgs plus one jet for the one jet spectrum at NNLO. And this is something that I think we know how to do these calculations now. We can do better than just Drellian-like processes. So we can really put jets in the final state. And this, I think, will be done within a few months. So there's going to be more information for the experimentalists. Stay tuned within the next couple months. That's but they don't just want the zero jet cross section. They want the greater than or equal to one, which is simple to obtain. I mean, it's tough to answer that because it depends how you chop it up, right? I mean, let's just look at one particular example that that I can just tell you right now. This V plus H that I showed you in the beginning, where you have this huge effect from putting the jet veto. What you really want to do here is remove TT bar background, right? And so removing TT bar background, cutting on a jet is not the same as cutting on a top quark jet. So if you do something a little more clever there about designing a trigger for top jets, vetoing on them, but including light flavor jets, you would remove most of this effect. Now, I see people shaking their head. I don't know if this is possible or not. I mean, that's one thing you could imagine doing in this case. I mean, maybe it doesn't work in detail. I mean, I think the other thing is that, I mean, given the fact that you guys are doing the analyses this way, people have developed the machinery and the formalism to actually address exactly what you're doing, right? And so this is why, you know, Matthias talked, I talked. We can do these kinds of calculations now. And, you know, I would say that what I would be interested in seeing is if when you actually move to using these kinds of calculations instead of what you're doing right now, what happens to the table that Jianming showed us? I mean, how dominant are the theory errors? You know, if they're still very dominant, that they start to be a limiting factor in the future, still, after switching, then we can start thinking about, is there another way to analyze it? I mean, whenever you say, you know, you made the comment that you can start slicing things up further. Whenever you say slicing things further, I start to get a little nervous.
So slicing things
differently. Slicing things differently, yeah, we could talk about that. I don't have anything. The only thing I had in mind is in the context of this analysis, which maybe it doesn't work.
For the PT, actually, in terms of the PT cut, you are very limited because ideally you want to raise the PT cut to reduce this theory as then you have fusion background. And you want to go low, and then you run into a pile up.
Yeah.
So we are sitting at a 25-30 dB as a new spot.
But you can imagine, you know, one category that has no jets above 30 and another that has no jets above 40 and treat them differently. You can imagine that.
I think that would be useful more in understanding how well the calculations work, because then you have you can basically tune your resummation, and you can check to see, you know, is it describing the spectrum correctly? It would be a useful cross-check on the calculation. There'd still be a large log in there. Multiple jets, there's more things to do, because then, I mean, when you're dealing with multiple jets, you really have different regions of phase space where different effective field theories are relevant. I mean, for example, in the two-jet spectrum, it's very easy to see that, you know, there's many different regions of phase space.
My dream is that the background Rich region, which is the same region that's difficult for you to calculate, everybody's happy.
Yeah. But for example, in the one-jet case, I mean, there's two definite regions of phase space. You know, in the one jet case, you have one very hard jet or you have a soft jet near the jet veto. And these things require different effective field theories. If you split the data up in that way, I think it would be useful. It's more stable to calculate. I mean, you have less of these issues with these clustering logarithms and soft collinear mixing terms. But I would be very worried about how the underlying event and soft physics affects that. But I would say in this context, I mean, this kind of thing that Tom mentioned, where you actually can tune this jet veto cut. I mean, what's the usefulness of, let's say, beam thrust over something like this? It's the fact that you have a little bit better theoretical control over the observable. It's a little cleaner theoretically. But if we can start testing, you know, the kind of resummations that are being done here to see how well it describes the spectrum by, let's say, tuning PT veto, I would say that then it becomes almost as good as something like beam thrust. Okay, and then you don't worry about any of these experimental issues about basically summing all parts of a detector as opposed to just a limited part. I mean, that's really the problem. The fact that experimentally you want to look at a limited part of a detector and not the whole detector. Theoretically, you want to look at the whole detector and not a limited region of phase space. So it's kind of, you're a little bit stuck there. But I think with the tools we have right now, cross-checks of the form that Tom mentioned would really, I think, go a long way towards establishing that we can, you know, describe this stuff well.
Mm-hmm. I would have the 1 plus 2 plus 8. So the 1 jet obviously is the step up in complexity. And my question is,
calculation, at what point exactly does that enter, and at what level would you see these non-global logs, and how would we ever, you know? I know people work on this for years now, but still we don't have an understanding of how to assemble these non-global logs. There must be something in the calculation where you enter, you know, where something qualitatively new appears that is not obvious how to deal with it. Normally, in the effective theory, if we set up things in the right way, we know how to assemble, right? Construction. So if we don't know how to set up, how to assemble the non-global logs, it means that there is something about them that we don't understand, like in terms of modes, structure of modes.
Well, I'm not sure if that was more, I don't know if that was really a question or more just like a general complaint about non-global logs. I mean, our limited understanding of the non-global logs right now and affecting our calculation is that they appear in the solve function as basically when you take the difference of two different pieces, you'll get a log of R. It's like a log of R. That's kind of what they're going to look like for us at the end of the day. But honestly, we're just at the beginning of trying.
You get logs of PTJ over PTV2, for instance.
But that's exactly what we're resumming. We're resumming basically log of square root of S hat over PTV2. So all sorts of things of the form PTJ or M Higgs over the low scale, we're resumming that entire thing. So non-global logs for us would basically they'd appear at the NLL prime level and they'd have a structure such as log of R. But I must admit that we've just started thinking about this kind of stuff. NLL prime.
Okay.
The solve function of one higher order, basically. I mean, I think this whole question of the central jet veto is something that I haven't thought much about it. I mean, one of these analyses I think that I quoted in the beginning is a VBF-like analysis. And this is the one that Mike talked about. I don't have any numbers for this. You know, I didn't do anything. But I know when I look at these numbers that appear here, MJJ greater than 500, and I know that your PT veto is 20 or 30 GeV, I mean, that's just like a big warning sign. I mean, anything where you have such a large scale and then you're cutting jets at such a low scale is potentially problematic. And I don't imagine why this would be any different. Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, if you can remove the jet veto, it's much safer theoretically. It's just a question of whether the experimental backgrounds allow you to do that.
Now, let's thank both of Matthias and Frank.